zombie, it would be necessary to have him turned into one. Shall I order a number one investigation on Mr. Gilt, my lord? Good heavens, no. He is far too clever. Order it on Mr. Horsefry. Really, sir, but you did say yesterday that you believed him to be no more than a greedy fool. A nervous fool, which is useful. He's a venal coward and a glutton. I've watched him sit down to a meal of pot-au-feu with white beans, and that was an impressive sight, Drumknot, which I will not easily forget. The sauce went everywhere. Those pink shirts he wears cost more than $100, too. Oh, he acquires other people's money, in a safe and secret and not very clever way. Send Clark Bryan.
Bryan, sir, said Drumknot. Are you sure? He's wonderful at devices, but quite inept on the street. He'll be seen.
Yes, Drumknot, I know. I would like Mr. Horsefry to become a little more nervous.
Ah, I see, sir.
Bettinari turned back to the window.
Tell me, Drumknot, he said, would you say I'm a tyrant?
Most certainly not, my lord, said Drumknot, tidying the desk.
But of course that's the problem, is it not? Who will tell the tyrant he is a tyrant?
That's a tricky one, my lord, certainly, said Drumknot, squaring up the files.
In his thoughts, which I have always considered to fare badly in translation, Buffon says that intervening in order to prevent a murder is to curtail the freedom of the murderer, and yet that freedom by definition is natural and universal without condition, said Vetinari. You may recall his famous dictum, if any man is not free, then I too am a small pie made of chicken, which has led to a considerable amount of debate. Thus we might consider, for example, that taking a bottle from a man killing himself with drink is a charitable, nay praiseworthy act, and yet freedom is curtailed once more. Mr. Gilt has studied his Buffon, but, I fear, failed to understand him. Freedom may be mankind's natural state, but so is sitting in a tree eating your dinner while it is still wriggling. On the other hand, Freidegger, in modal context it is, claims that all freedom is limited, artificial, and therefore illusory, a shared hallucination at best. No sane mortal is truly free, because true freedom is so terrible that only the mad or the divine can face it with open eyes. It overwhelms the soul, very much like the state he elsewhere describes as von alles vollkommen und verständlich das Daskeit. What position would you take here, Drumknot?
I've always thought, my lord, that what the world really needs are filing boxes which are not so flimsy, said Drumknot after a moment's pause.
Said Lord Vetinari. A point to think about, certainly. He stopped. On the carved decorations over the room's fireplace, a small cherub began to turn with a faint squeaking noise. Vetinari raised an eyebrow at Drumknot.
"I shall have a word with Clark Bryan immediately, my lord," said the clerk.
"Good. Tell him it's time he got out into the fresh air more." Chapter 4. A Sign. Dark clerks and dead postmasters. A werewolf in the watch. The wonderful pin. Mr. Lipthig reads letters that are not there. Hugo the hairdresser is surprised. Mr. Parker buys fripperies. The nature of social untruths. Princess in the tower. A man is not dead while his name is still spoken.
"Now then, Mr. Lipthig, what good will violence do?"
Mr. Pump rumbled. He rocked on his huge feet as Moist struggled in his grip. Groat and Stanley were huddled at the far end of the locker room. One of Mr. Groat's natural remedies was bubbling over onto the floor, where the boards were staining purple.
"They were all accidents, Mr. Lipthig, all accidents," Groat babbled. "The watch was all over the place by the fourth one. They were all accidents, they said."
"Oh, yes," screamed Moist. "Four in 5 weeks, eh? I bet that happens all the time round here. Ye gods, I've been done up good and brown. I'm dead, right? Just not lying down yet. Vetinari, there's a man who knows how to save the price of a rope. I'm done for."
"You'll feel better for a nice cup of bismuth and brimstone tea, sir,"
Groat wavered. "I've got the kettle boiling. A cup of tea is not going to be sufficient." Moist got a grip on himself, or at least began to act as if he had, and took a deep, theatrical breath. "Okay. Okay, Mr. Pump, you can let go now." The golem released his grip. Moist straightened up. "Well, Mr. Groat," he said.
"Looks like you're genuine after all, then," the old man said. "One of the dark clerks wouldn't have gone bursar like that. We thought you was one of his lordship's special gentlemen, see?"
Groat fussed around the kettle.
"No offence, but you've got a bit more colour than the average pen pusher."
"Dark clerks," said Moist, and then recollection dawned. "Oh, do you mean those stocky little men in black suits with bowler hats?"
"The very same. Scholarship boys at the Assassin's Guild, some of them. I heard that they can do some nasty things when they've a mind."
"I thought you called them pen pushers."
"Yeah, but I didn't say where."
Groat caught Moist's expression and coughed.
"Sorry, didn't mean it. Just my little joke. We reckon the last new postmaster we had, Mr. Wobbleberry, he was a dark clerk. Can't hardly blame him with a name like that. He was always snooping around."
"And why do you think that was?" said Moist.
"Well, Mr. Mutable, he was the first decent chap. He fell down into the big hall from the fifth floor. Smack, sir. Smack! Onto the marble. Head first. It was a bit splashy, sir."
Moist glanced at Stanley, who was starting to tremble.
"Then there was Mr. Sideburn. He fell down the back stairs and broke his neck, sir. Oh, excuse me, sir, it's 11:43.
Groat walked over to the door and opened it. Tiddles walked through. Groat shut the door again.
"At 3 in the morning it was. Right down 5 flights. Broke just about every bone you could break, sir."
"You mean he was wandering around without a light?"
"Dunno, sir. But I know about the stairs. The stairs have lamps burning all night, sir. Stanley fills them every day, regular as tiddles."
"Use those stairs a lot, then, do you?" said Moist.
"Never, sir, except for the lamps. Nearly everywhere on that side is bunged up with mail. But it's a post office regulation, sir."
"And the next man?" said Moist a little hoarsely. "Another accidental fall?"
"Oh, no, sir. Mr. Ignavia, that was his name. They said it was his heart. He was just lying dead on the fifth floor, dead as a doorknob. Face all contorted like he'd seen a ghost. Natural causes, they said. Well, the watch was all over the place by then, you may depend on it. No one had been near him, they said, and there was not a mark on him. Surprised you didn't know all about this, sir. It was in the paper."
"Except you don't get much chance to keep up with the news in a condemned cell," Moist thought.
"Oh, yes," he said.
"And how would they know no one had been near him?" Groat leaned forward and lowered his voice conspiratorially.
"Everyone knows there's a werewolf in the watch, and one of them could bloody nearly smell what colour clothes someone was wearing."
"A werewolf," said Moist flatly.
"Yeah. Anyway, the one before him..."
"A werewolf?
That's what I said, sir," said Groat. "A damn werewolf. Takes all sorts to make a world, sir. Anyway, a werewolf..."
Moist awoke from the horror.
"And they don't tell visitors?" "No. How'd they do that, sir?" said Groat in a kindly voice. "Put it on a sign outside. Welcome to Ankh-Morpork. We have a werewolf, sir. The watch has got loads of dwarfs and trolls and a golem. A free golem, saving your presence, Mr. Pump. And a couple of gnomes and a zombie, even a nobs."
"Nobs? What's a nobs?"
"Corporal Nobby Nobs, sir. Not met him yet. They say he's got an official chitty saying he's human. And who needs one of those, eh? Fortunately, there's only one of him, so he can't breed. Anyway, we got a bit of everything, sir. Very cosmopolitan. You don't like werewolves?"
"They know who you are by your smell," thought Moist. "They're as bright as a human and can track you better than any wolf. They can follow a trail that's days old, even if you cover yourself with scent. Especially if you cover yourself with scent. Oh, there are ways round if you know that there's going to be a werewolf on your trail. No wonder they caught up with me. There should be a law."
"Not a lot," he said aloud, and glanced at Stanley again.
It was useful to watch Stanley when Groat was talking. Now the boy had his eyes turned up so much that they were practically all whites.
"And Mr. Wobbleberry," he said. "He was investigating for veterinary, eh? What happened to him?"
Stanley was shaking like a bush in a high wind.
"And you did get given the big key ring, sir?" Groat inquired, his voice trembling with innocence.
"Yes, of course."
"I bet there is one key missing," said Groat. "The watch took it. It was the only one. Some doors ought to stay closed, sir." "It's all over and done with, sir. Mr. Wobbleberry died of an industrial accident, they said. Nobody near him. You don't want to go there, sir. Sometimes things get so broke it's best to walk away, sir."
"I can't," said Moist. "I am the Postmaster General. And this is my building, isn't it? I'll decide where I go, Junior Postman Groat.
Stanley shut his eyes.
Yes, sir, said Groat, as if talking to a child. But you don't want to go there, sir.
His head was all over the wall,
Stanley quavered.
Oh, dear. Now you set him off, sir, said Groat, scuttling across the boy. It's all right, lad. I'll just get you your pills.
What's the most expensive pin ever made commercially, Stanley? Said Moist quickly. It was like pulling a lever. Stanley's expression went from agonized grief to scholarly cogitation in an instant.
Commercially, leaving aside those special pins made for exhibitions and trade shows, including the Great Pin of 1899, then probably it is the number 3 broad-headed chicken extra longs made for the lace-making market by the noted pinner Josiah Doldrum, I would say. They were hand-drawn and had his trademark silver head with a microscopic engraving of a cockerel. It's believed that fewer than 100 were made before his death, sir. According to Hubert Spider's pin catalogue, examples can fetch between $50 and $65, depending on condition. A number 3 broad-headed extra long would grace any true pinhead's collection.
Only I spotted this in the street, said Moist, extracting one of that morning's purchases from his lapel. I was walking down Market Street, and there it was, between 2 cobblestones. I thought it looked unusual for a pin.
Stanley pushed away the fussing Groat and carefully took the pin from Moist's fingers. A very large magnifying glass appeared as if by magic in his other hand. The room held its breath as the pin was subjected to serious scrutiny. Then Stanley looked up at Moist in amazement.
"You knew?" he said. "And you spotted this in the street? I thought you didn't know anything about pins."
"Oh, not really, but I dabbled a bit as a boy," said Moist, waving a hand deprecatingly to suggest that he had been too foolish to turn a schoolboy hobby into a lifetime's obsession. "You know, a few of the old brass imperials, one or two oddities, like an unbroken pair or a double-header, the occasional cheap packet of mixed pins on approval. Thank the gods," he thought, "for the skill of speed-reading."
"Oh, there's never anything worthwhile in those,"
said Stanley, and slid again into the voice of the academic.
"While most pinheads do indeed begin with a casually acquired flashy novelty pin, followed by the contents of their grandmother's pincushion, the path to a truly worthwhile collection lies not in the simple disbursement of money in the nearest pin emporium. Oh, no. Any dilettante can become king pin with enough expenditure. But for the true pinhead, the real pleasure is in the joy of the chase. The pin fairs, the house clearances, and, who knows, a casual glint in the gutter that turns out to be a well-preserved double fast or an unbroken two-pointer. Well, is it said, see a pin and pick it up, and all day long you'll have a pin."
Moist nearly applauded. It was, word for word, what J. Lanugo Alsbury had written in the introduction to his work. And, much more important, he now had an unshakable friend in Stanley. That was to say, his darker regions added, Stanley was friends with him. The boy, all panic subsumed by the joy of pins, was holding the pin up to the light.
"Magnificent," he breathed, all terrors fled. "Clean as a new pin. I have a place ready and waiting for this in my pin folder, sir."
"Yes, I thought you might." His head was all over the wall. Somewhere there was a locked door, and Moist didn't have the key. 4 of his predecessors had predeceased in this very building. And there was no escape. Being Postmaster General was a job for life, one way or the other. That was why Vetinari had put him here. He needed a man who couldn't walk away, and who was incidentally completely expendable. It didn't matter if Moist von Lipwig died. He was already dead. And then he tried not to think about Mr. Pump. How many other golems had worked their way to freedom in the service of the city? Had there been a Mr. Saw, fresh from 100 years in a pit of sawdust? Or Mr. Shovel, Mr. Axe, maybe? And had there been one here when the last poor guy had found the key or a good lockpick, and was about to open it, when behind him someone called, maybe, Mr. Hammer? Yes, oh gods, yes, raised his fist for one sudden terminal blow. No one had been near him. But they weren't people, were they? They were tools. It'd be an industrial accident. His head was all over the wall. I'm going to find out about this. I have to, otherwise it'll lie in wait for me, and everyone will tell me lies. But I am the Fibbermeister.
"Hmm?"
he said, aware that he'd missed something.
"I said, could I go and put this in my collection, Postmaster?" said Stanley.
"What? Oh, yes, fine, yes. Give it a really good polish, too."
As the boy gangled off to his end of the locker room, and he did gangle, Moist caught Groat looking at him shrewdly.
"Well done, Mr. Lipwig," he said. "Well done."
"Thank you, Mr. Groat."
"Good eyesight you've got there,"
the old man went on.
"Well, the light was shining off it. Nah, I meant to see cobbles in Market Street, it being all brick paving up there."
Moist returned his blank stare with one even blanker.
"Bricks, cobbles, who cares," he said. "Yeah, right. Not important, really," said Groat.
"And now," said Moist, feeling the need for some fresh air, "there's a little errand I have to run. I'd like you to come with me, Mr. Groat. Can you find a crowbar anywhere? Bring it, please. And I'll need you too, Mr. Pump."
Werewolves and golems. Golems and werewolves, Moist thought. "I'm stuck here. I might as well take it seriously. I will show them a sign."
"There's a little habit I have," said Moist, as he led the way through the streets. "It's to do with signs."
"Signs, sir?"
said Groat, trying to keep close to the walls.
"Yes, Junior Postman Groat, signs," said Moist, noticing the way the man winced at Junior. "Particularly signs with missing letters. When I see one, I automatically read what the missing letters say."
"And how can you do that, sir, when they are missing?" said Groat.
"Ah, so there's a clue as to why you're still sitting in a run-down old building making tea from rocks and weeds all day," Moist thought. Aloud, he said, "It's a knack. Now, I could be wrong, of course, but, we turn left here."
This was quite a busy street, and the shop was in front of them. It was everything that Moist had hoped.
"Voila," he said, and remembering his audience, he added, "That is to say, there we have it."
"It's a barber's shop," said Groat uncertainly. "For ladies."
"Ah, you're a man of the world, Tolliver. There's no fooling you," said Moist. "And the name over the window in those large blue-green letters is..."
"Hugos,"
said Groat.
"And?"
"Yes, Hugos," said Moist. "No apostrophe present, in fact. And the reason for this is..."
"You could work with me a little here, perhaps?"
Groat
stared frantically at the letters, defying them to reveal their meaning.
"Close enough," said Moist. "There is no apostrophe there because there was, and is, no apostrophe on the uplifting slogan that adorns our beloved post office, Mr. Groat."
He waited for light to dawn.
"Those big metal letters were stolen from our façade, Mr. Groat. I mean, the front of the building. They're the reason for Glom of Knit, Mr. Groat."
It took a little time for Mr. Groat's mental sunrise to take place, but Moist was ready when it did.
"No, no, no," he said, grabbing the old man's greasy collar as he lurched forward and almost pulling Groat off his feet. "That's not how we deal with this, is it?
That's post office property. That's worse than stealing, that is. That's treason,"
Groat yelled.
"Quite so," said Moist. "Mr. Pump, if you would just hold on to our friend here, I will go and discuss the matter."
Moist handed over the furious junior postman and brushed himself off. He looked a bit rumpled, but it would have to do.
"What are you going to do, then?" said Groat.
Moist smiled his sunshine smile.
"Something I'm good at, Mr. Groat. I'm going to talk to people."
Moist crossed the road and opened the shop door. The bell jangled. Inside the hairdresser's shop was an array of little booths, and the air smelled sweet and cloying and somehow pink. Right by the door was a little desk with a big open diary. There were lots of flowers around, and the young woman at the desk gave him a haughty look that was going to cost her employer a lot of money. She was waiting for him to speak. Moist put on a grave expression, leaned down, and said in a voice that had all the characteristics of a whisper, but also seemed to be able to carry quite a long way,
"Can I see Mr. Hugo, please? It is very important."
"On what business would that be?"
"Well, it's a little delicate," said Moist.
He could see the tops of permed heads turning.
"But you can tell him it's good news."
"Well, if it's good news,
tell him I think I can persuade Lord Vetinari that this can be settled without charges being brought."
"Probably," said Moist, lowering his voice just enough to increase the curiosity of the customers, while not so much as to be inaudible.
The woman stared at him in horror.
"You can,
She groped for an ornate speaking tube, but Moist took it gently from her hand, whistled expertly down it, lifted it to his ear, and flashed her a smile.
"Thank you," he said.
For what did not matter.
Smile, say the right kind of words in the right kind of voice, and always, always radiate confidence like a supernova. A voice in his ear, faint as a spider trapped in the matchbox, said, "Hugo," said Moist, "it's good of you to make time for me. It's Moist. Moist von Lipwig, Postmaster General." He glanced at the speaking tube. It disappeared into the ceiling. "So kind of you to assist us, Hugo. It's these missing letters. 5 missing letters, to be exact. Squeak! Shabadakwik! Screech fit bricks! Don't really carry that kind of thing, Hugo, but if you'd care to look out of your window, you'll see my personal assistant, Mr. Pump. He's standing on the other side of the street. And he's 8 feet tall and carrying a huge crowbar," Moist added mentally. He winked at the lady sitting at the desk, who was watching him in a kind of awe. You had to keep people's skills polished at all times. He heard the muffled expletive through the floor. Via the speaking tube, it became, "Forgotten Nick and Bibble." "Yes," said Moist. "Perhaps I could come up and speak to you directly." 10 minutes later, Moist crossed the road with care and smiled at his staff. "Mr. Pump, if you would be so good as to step over there and pry out our letters, please," he said. "Try not to damage anything. Mr. Hugo has been very cooperative. And Tolliver, you've lived here a long time, haven't you? You'll know where to hire men with ropes, steeplejacks, that sort of thing. I want those letters back on our building by midday, okay?"
"That'll cost a lot of money, Mr. Litwig," said Groat, staring at him in amazement.
Moist pulled a bag out of his pocket and jingled it. $100 should more than cover it," he said. Mr. Hugo was very apologetic and very, very inclined to be helpful. Says he bought them years ago off a man in a pub, and is only too happy to pay for them to be returned. It's amazing how nice people can be if approached in the right way. There was a clang from the other side of the street. Mr. Pump had already removed the H without any apparent effort. "Speak softly and employ a huge man with a crowbar," thought Moist. This might be bearable after all. The weak sunlight glinted on the S as it was swung into position. There was quite a crowd. People in Ankh-Morpork always paid attention to people on rooftops in case there was a chance of an interesting suicide. There was a cheer just on general principles when the last letter was hammered back into place. 4 dead men, Moist thought, looking up at the roof. I wonder if the watch would talk to me. Do they know about me? Do they think I'm dead? Do I want to speak to policemen? No. Damn. The only way I can get out of this is by running forward, not going back. Bloody veterinari, he thought. But there's a way to win. He could make money. He was part of the government, wasn't he? Governments took money off people. That's what they were for. He had people skills, didn't he? He could persuade people that brass was gold that had got a bit tarnished, that glass was diamond, that tomorrow there was going to be free beer. He'd outfox them all. He wouldn't try to escape, not yet. If a golem could buy its freedom, then so could he. He'd buckle down and bustle and look busy, and he'd send all the bills to veterinary, because this was government work. How could the man object? And if Moist von Lipwig couldn't cream a little something, a big something off the top and the bottom, and maybe a little off the sides, then he didn't deserve to. And then, when it was all going well and the cash was rolling in, well, then there'd be time to make plans for the big one. Enough money bought a lot of men with sledgehammers. The workmen pulled themselves back onto the flat roof. There was another ragged cheer from a crowd that reckoned it hadn't been bad entertainment, even if no one had fallen off. "What do you think, Mr. Groat?" he said.
"Looks nice, sir, looks nice,"
said Groat as the crowd dispersed and they walked back to the post office building. "Not disturbing anything, then?" said Moist. Groat patted the surprised Moist on the arm.
"I don't know why his lordship sent you, sir. Really, I don't," he whispered. "You mean well, I can see, but take my advice, sir, and get out of here."
Moist glanced toward the building's doors. Mr. Pump was standing beside them. Just standing, with his arms hanging down. The fire in his eyes was a banked glow. "I can't do that," he said.
"Nice of you to say so, sir, but this place isn't for a young man with a future," said Groat. "Now, Stanley, he's all right if he's got his pins, but you, sir, you could go far."
"No, I don't think I can," said Moist. "Honestly, my place, Mr. Groat, is here."
"God's bless you for saying that, sir. God's bless you," said Groat.
Tears were beginning to roll down his face.
"We used to be heroes," he said. "People wanted us. Everyone watched out for us. Everyone knew us. This was a great place once. Once we were postmen."
"Mister?"
Moist turned. Three people were hurrying toward him, and he had to quell an automatic urge to turn and run, especially when one of them shouted, "Yeah, that's him." He recognized the greengrocer from this morning. An elderly couple were trailing behind him. The older man, who had the determined face and upright bearing of one who subdued cabbages daily, stopped an inch in front of Moist and bellowed,
"Are you the postman, young man?"
"Yes, sir, I suppose I am," said Moist. "How can I—"
"You delivered me this letter from Aggie here. I'm Antimony Parker," the man roared. "Now, there's some people that say it was a little bit on the late side."
"Oh," said Moist. "Well, I—"
"That took a bit of nerve, young man."
"I'm very sorry that—" Moist began. People skills weren't much good in the face of Mr. Parker. He was one of the impervious people whose grasp of volume control was about as good as his understanding of personal space.
"Sorry?" Parker shouted. "What have you got me sorry about? Not your fault, lad. You weren't even born. More fool me for thinking she didn't care, eh? Ha! I was so downhearted, lad, I went right out and joined the,
His red face wrinkled.
You know, camels, funny hats, sand. What are you going to forget?"
"The Clatchian Foreign Legion," said Moist.
"That was it. And when I came back, I met Sadie, and Aggie had met her Frederick, and then we both got settled and forgot the other one was alive, and then blow me down if this letter didn't arrive from Aggie. Me and my lad has spent half the morning tracking her down, and, to cut a long story short, lad, we're getting married Saturday, 'cause of you, boy."
Mr. Parker was one of those men who turned into teak with age. When he slapped Moist on the back, it was like being hit with a chair.
"Won't Frederick and Sadie object?"
Moist wheezed.
"Oh, doubt it. Frederick passed away 10 years ago, and Sadie's been buried up in small gods for the last 5,
Mr. Parker bellowed cheerfully.
"And we were sorry to see him go. But, as Aggie says, it was all meant to be, and you were sent by higher power. And I say it took a man with real backbone to come and deliver that letter after all this time. There's many that would have tossed it aside like it was of no account. You do me and a future second Mrs. Parker a great favour if you was to be a guest of honour at our wedding, and I, for one, won't take no for an answer. I'm Grand Master of the Guild of Merchants this year, too. We might not be posh like the assassins or the alchemists, but there's a lot of us, and I shall put in a word on your behalf. You can depend on that. My lad Georgie will be down later on with the invitations for you to deliver. Now you're back in business. It will be a great honour for me, my boy, if you would shake me by the end."
He thrust out a huge hand. Moist took it, and old habits died hard. Firm grip, steady gaze.
"Ah, you're an honest man, all right," said Parker. "I'm never mistaken."
He clapped his hand on Moist's shoulder, causing a knee joint to crunch.
"What's your name, lad?"
"Litwig, sir. Moist von Litwig," Moist said. He was afraid he'd gone deaf in one ear.
"Oh, a von, eh?" said Parker. "Well, you're doing damn well for a foreigner, and I don't care who knows it. Got to be going now. Aggie wants to buy fripperies."
The woman came up to Moist, stood on tiptoe, and kissed him on the cheek.
"And I know a good man when I see one," she said. "Do you have a young lady?"
"What? No, not at all. No," said Moist.
"I'm sure you shall," she said, smiling sweetly. "And while we're very grateful to you, I would advise you to propose in person. We do so much look forward to seeing you on Saturday."
Moist watched her scurry away after her long-lost swain.
"You delivered a letter?"
said Groat, horrified.
"Yes, Mr. Groat, I didn't mean to, but I just happened to be—"
"You took one of the old letters and you delivered it?"
said Groat, as if the concept was something he could not fit into his head. His head was all over the wall. Moist blinked.
"We are supposed to deliver the mail, man. That's our job, remember?"
"You delivered a letter," breathed Groat.
"What was the date on it?"
"I can't remember. More than 40 years ago."
"What was it like? Was it in good condition?"
Groat insisted. Moist glared at the little postman. A small crowd was forming around them, as was the Ankh-Morpork way.
"It was a 40-year-old letter in a cheap envelope," he snarled. "And that's what it looked like. It never got delivered, and it upset the lives of 2 people. I delivered it, and it's made 2 people very happy. What's the problem, Mr. Groat?"
"Yes, what is it?"
This was to a woman who was tugging at his sleeve.
"I said, is it true you're opening the old place again?" she repeated. "My grandad used to work there."
"Well done him," said Moist.
"He said there was a curse,"
said the woman, as if the idea was rather pleasing.
"Really?" said Moist. "Well, I could do with a good curse right now, as a matter of fact.
"'It lives under the floor and drives you mad!' she went on, enjoying the syllable so much that she seemed loath to let it go. "'Mad!'
"'Really?' said Moist. "'Well, we do not believe in going crazy in the postal service, do we, Mr. Groat?' He stopped. Mr. Groat had the expression of one who did believe in going crazy.
"'You daft old woman!' Groat yelled. "'What do you have to tell him that for?'
"'Mr. Groat!' snapped Moist. "'I wish to speak to you inside.' He grabbed the old man by the shoulder and very nearly carried him through the amused crowd, dragged him into the building and slammed the door. "'I've had enough of this,' he said. "'Enough of dark comments and mutterings. Do you understand? What is going on here? What went on here? You tell me right now, or—'
The little man's eyes were full of fear. "'This is not me,' Moist thought. "'This is not the way. People's skills, eh?'
"'You tell me right now, Senior Postman Groat!' he snapped.
The old man's eyes widened.
"'Senior Postman?'
"'I am the postmaster in this vicinity, yes,' said Moist. "'That means I can promote, yes? Senior Postman, indeed. On probation, of course. Now, will you tell me what—'
"'Don't you hurt Mr. Groat, sir,'
said a ringing voice behind Moist.
Groat looked past Moist into the gloom and said,
"'It's all right, Stanley. There's no need for that. We don't want a little moment.'
To Moist he whispered,
"'Best you put me down gently, sir.'
Moist did so with exaggerated care and turned around. The boy was standing behind him with a glazed look on his face and the big kettle raised.
"'You mustn't hurt Mr. Groat, sir,' he said hoarsely.
Moist pulled a pin out of his lapel.
"'Of course not, Stanley. By the way, is this a genuine clay-feather medium sharp?'
Stanley dropped the kettle, suddenly oblivious to everything but the inch of silvery steel between Moist's fingers. One hand was already pulling out his magnifying glass.
"'Oh, let me see,' he said in a level, thoughtful voice. "'Oh, yes. Ha! No, sorry. It's an easy mistake to make. Look at the marks on the shoulder here, see? And the head was never coiled. This is machine-made. Probably by one of the Happily brothers. Short run, I imagine, hasn't got their sigil, though. Could have been done by a creative apprentice. Not worth much, I'm afraid, unless you find someone who specialises in the minutiae of the Happily pinery.
"'I'll, just make a cup of tea, shall I?'
said Groat, picking up the kettle as it rolled backwards and forwards on the floor.
"'Well done again, Mr. Moist. Senior Postman Groat, right?
"'Off you go with, yes, probationary Senior Postman Groat, Stanley,' said Moist as kindly as he could manage. He looked up and added sharply, "'I just want to talk to Mr. Pump here.'
Stanley looked around at the golem, who was right behind him. It was astonishing how quietly a golem could move. He'd crossed the floor like a shadow, and now stood with one still fist raised like the wrath of gods.
"'Oh, I didn't see you standing there, Mr. Pump,' said Stanley cheerfully. "'Why is your hand up?'
The holes in the golem's face bathed the boy in red light.
"'I wanted to ask the postmaster a question,' said the golem slowly.
"'Oh, all right,'
said Stanley, as if he hadn't been about to brain Moist a moment before.
"'Do you want your pin back, Mr. Moist?' he added.
And when Moist waved him away, he went on,
"'All right, I'll put it in next month's charity pin auction.'
When the door had shut behind him, Moist looked up at the golem's impassive face.
"'You lied to him.
Are you allowed to lie, Mr. Pump?' he said. "'And you can lower that arm, by the way.'
"'I have been instructed as to the nature of social untruths, yes.'
"'You are going to smash his brains out,' said Moist.
"'I would have endeavoured not to,' the golem rumbled. "'However, I cannot allow you to come to inappropriate harm. It was a heavy kettle.'
"'You can't do that, you idiot,' said Moist, who'd noticed the use of inappropriate.
"'I should have let him kill you,' said the golem. "'It would not have been his fault. His head is not right.'
"'It'd be even less right if you walloped it. Look, I sorted it out.'
"'Yes,' Pump said. "'You have a talent. It is a pity you'll misuse it.'
"'Do you understand anything I'm saying?' shouted Moist. "'You can't just go around killing people.'
"'Why not, you do?'
the golem lowered his arm.
"'What?'
said Moist.
"'I do not. Who told you that?'
"'I've worked it out. You have killed 2.338 people,' said the golem calmly.
"'I have never laid a finger on anyone in my life, Mr. Pump. I may be all the things you know I am, but I am not a killer. I have never so much as drawn a sword.'
"'No, you have not. But you have stolen, embezzled, defrauded, and swindled without discrimination, Mr. Lipwig. You have ruined businesses and destroyed jobs. When banks fail, it is seldom bankers who starve. Your actions have taken money from those who had little enough to begin with. In a myriad small ways, you have hastened the deaths of many. You did not know them. You did not see them bleed. But you snatched bread from their mouths and tore clothes from their backs. For sport, Mr. Lipwig. For sport. For the joy of the game.
Moist's mouth had dropped open. It shut. It opened again. It shut again. You can never find repartee when you need it. "You're nothing but a walking flowerpot, Pump 19," he snapped. "Where did that come from?"
"I have read the details of your many crimes, Mr. Lipwig, and pumping water teaches one the value of rational thought. You took from others because you were clever and they were stupid."
"Hold on. Most of the time they thought they were swindling me."
"You set out to trap them, Mr. Lipwig," said Mr. Pump.
Moist went to prod the golem meaningfully, but decided against it just in time. A man could break a finger that way. "Well, think about this," he said. "I'm paying for all that. I was nearly hanged, goddammit."
"Yes, but even now you harbour thoughts of escape, of somehow turning the situation to your advantage. They say the leopard does not change his shorts."
"But you have to obey my orders, yes?" snarled Moist.
"Yes."
"Then screw your damn head off." For a moment, the red eyes flickered. When Pump spoke next, it was in the voice of Lord Veterinari. "Ah, Lipwig, despite everything, you do not pay attention. Mr. Pump cannot be instructed to destroy himself. I would have thought you at least could have worked this out. If you instruct him to do so again, punitive action will be taken." The golem blinked again. "How did you..." Moist began.
"I have perfect recall of legal verbal instructions," said the golem in his normal rumbling tone. "I surmise that Lord Veterinari, mindful of your way of thinking, left that message because..."
"I meant the voice."
"Perfect recall, Mr. Lipwig," Pump replied. "I can speak with all the voices of men."
"Really? How nice for you." Moist stared up at Mr. Pump. There was never any animation in that face. There was a nose of sorts, but it was just a lump in the clay. The mouth moved when he spoke, and the gods knew how baked clay could move like that. Indeed, they probably did know. The eyes never closed, they merely dimmed. "Can you really read my thoughts?" he said.
"No, I merely extrapolate from past behaviour."
"Well," Moist said, once again stuck for words. He glared up at the expressionless face that nevertheless contrived to be disapproving. He was used to looks of anger, indignation and hatred. They were part of the job. But what was a golem? Just dirt. Fired earth. People looking at you as though you were less than the dust beneath their feet was one thing. But it was strangely unpleasant when even the dust did that too. "Don't," he finished lamely. "Go and work. Yes, go on. That's what you do. That's what you're for." It was called the Lucky Clax Tower, Tower 181. It was close enough to the town of Bjonk for a man to be able to go and get a hot bath and a good bed on his days off. But since this was Überwald, there wasn't too much local traffic, and this was important. It was way, way up in the mountains, and management didn't like to go that far. In the good old days of last year, when the Hour of the Dead took place every night, it was a happy tower, because both the upline and the downline got the hour at the same time, so there was an extra pair of hands for maintenance. Now, Tower 181 did maintenance on the fly, or not at all, just like all the others. But it was still, proverbially, a good tower to man. Mostly man, anyway. Back down on the plains, it was a standing joke that 181 was staffed by vampires and werewolves. In fact, like a lot of towers, it was often manned by kids. Everyone knew it happened. Actually, the new management probably didn't, but wouldn't have done anything about it if they'd found out, apart from carefully forgetting that they'd known. kids didn't need to be paid. The mostly young men on the towers worked hard in all weather for just enough money. They were loners, hard dreamers, fugitives from the law that the law had forgotten, or just from everybody else. They had a special kind of directed madness. They said the rattle of the clacks got into your head, and your thoughts beat time with it, so sooner or later you could tell what messages were going through by listening to the rattle of the shutters. In their towers, they drank hot tea out of strange tin mugs, much wider at the bottom, so that they didn't fall over when gales banged into the tower. On leave, they drank alcohol out of anything. And they talked a gibberish of their own, of donkey and non-donkey, system overhead and packet space, of drumming it and hot footing, of a 181, which was good, or flock, which was bad, or totally flocked, really not good at all, and plug code and hog code and jacquard. And they liked kids, who reminded them of the ones they left behind or would never have, and kids loved the towers. They'd come and hang around and do odd jobs, and maybe pick up the craft of semaphore just by watching. They tended to be bright. They mastered the keyboard and levers as if by magic. They usually had good eyesight, and what they were doing, most of them, was running away from home without actually leaving. Because up on the towers, you might believe you could see to the rim of the world. You could certainly see several other towers on a good, clear day. You pretended that you, too, could read messages by listening to the rattle of the shutters, while under your fingers flowed the names of faraway places you'd never see but, on the tower, were somehow connected to. She was known as Princess to the men on Tower 181, although she was really Alice. She was 13, could run a line for hours on end without needing help, and later on had an interesting career which... But anyway, she remembered this one conversation on this day because it was strange. Not all signals were messages. Some were instructions to towers. Some, as you operated your levers to follow the distant signal, made things happen in your own tower. Princess knew all about this. A lot of what travelled on the Grand Trunk was called the overhead. It was instructions to towers, reports, messages about messages, even chatter between operators, although this was strictly forbidden these days. It was all in code. It was very rare you got plain in the overhead. But now...
"There it goes again," she said. "It must be wrong. It's got no origin code and no address. It's overhead, but it's in plain."
On the other side of the tower, sitting in a seat facing the opposite direction, because he was operating the upline, was Roger, who was 17 and already working for his Tower Master certificate. His hand didn't stop moving as he said,
"What did it say?" "There was GNU, and I know that's a code, and then just a name. It was John Deerhart. Was it a..."
"You sent it on," said Grandad. Grandad had been hunched in the corner, repairing a shutterbox in this cramped shed halfway up the tower. Grandad was the tower master, and had been everywhere and knew everything. Everyone called him Grandad. He was 26. He was always doing something in the tower when she was working the line, even though there was always a boy in the other chair. She didn't work out why until later.
"Yes, because it was a G-code," said Princess.
"Then you did right. Don't worry about it."
"Yeah, but I've sent that name before, several times. Upline and downline. Just a name, no message or anything."
She had a sense that something was wrong, but she went on.
"I know a U at the end means it has to be turned around at the end of the line, and an N means not logged."
This was showing off, but she'd spent hours reading the cipher book.
"So it's just a name, going up and down all the time. Where's the sense in that?"
Something was really wrong. Roger was still working his line, but he was staring ahead with a thunderous expression. Then Grandad said,
"Very clever, Princess. You're dead right."
"Ha!" said Roger.
"I'm sorry if I did something wrong," said the girl meekly. "I just thought it was strange." "Who's John Deerhart?"
"He fell off a tower," said Grandad.
"Ha!" said Roger, working his shutters as if he suddenly hated them.
"He's dead,"
said Princess.
"Well, some people say..." Roger began.
"Roger!"
snapped Grandad. It sounded like a warning.
"I know about sending home," said Princess, "and I know the souls of dead linesmen stay on the trunk."
"Who told you that?" said Grandad.
Princess was bright enough to know that someone would get into trouble if she was too specific.
"Oh, I just heard it," she said airily. "Somewhere."
"Someone was trying to scare you," said Grandad, looking at Roger's reddening ears.
It hadn't sounded scary to Princess. If you had to be dead, it seemed a lot better to spend your time flying between the towers than lying underground. But she was bright enough, too, to know when to drop a subject. It was Grandad who spoke next, after a long pause broken only by the squeaking of the new shutter bars. When he did speak, it was as if something was on his mind.
"We keep that name moving on the overhead," he said,
and it seemed to Princess that the wind in the shutter arrays above her blew more forlornly, and the everlasting clicking of the shutters grew more urgent.
"He'd never have wanted to go home. He was a real linesman. His name is in the code, in the wind, in the rigging, and the shutters. Haven't you ever heard the saying, 'Man's not dead while his name is still spoken?'"
Chapter 5. Lost in the Post. In which Stanley experiences the joy of sacks, Mr. Groat's ancestral fears, Horsefry is worried, Reacher guilt, a man of society, the stairway of letters, mail slide, Mr. Lipwig sees it, hoodwinked, the postman's walk, the hat. Stanley polished his pins. He did so with a look of beatific concentration, like a man dreaming with his eyes open. The collection sparkled on the folded strips of brown paper and the rolls of black felt that made up the landscape of the true pinhead's world. Beside him was his large desktop magnifying glass, and by his feet a sack of miscellaneous pins bought last week from a retiring needlewoman. He was putting off the moment of opening it to savour it all the more. Of course, it had almost certainly turn out to be full of everyday brasses, with maybe the occasional flathead or line flaw, but the thing was, you never knew. That was the joy of sacks. You never knew. Non-collectors were woefully unconcerned about pins, treating them as if they were no more than thin, pointy bits of metal for sticking things to other things. Many a wonderful pin of great worth had been found in a sack of brasses. And now he had a number 3 broad-headed chicken extra long, thanks to kind Mr. Lipwig. The world shone, like the pins so neatly ranged on the felt rolled out in front of him. He might smell faintly of cheese and have athlete's foot extending to the knee, but just now Stanley soared through glittering skies on wings of silver. Groat sat by the stove, chewing his fingernails and muttering to himself. Stanley paid no attention, since pins were not the subject.
"Appointed, right? Never mind what the order says. He can promote anyone, right? That means I get the extra gold button on my sleeve and the pay, right? None of the others call me senior postman. And when all said and done, he delivered a letter. Had a letter, saw the address, delivered it, just like that. Maybe he has got postman's blood. And he got them metal letters put back. Letters again, see? That's a sign, sure enough. Ha! He can read words that ain't there."
Groat spat out a fragment of fingernail and frowned.
"But then you want to know about the new pie. Oh, yeah. But it'd be like scratching at a scab. Could be bad. Very bad. But the way he got them letters back was very good. Maybe it's true that one day we'll get a true postmaster again, just like they say. Yea, he will tread the abandoned roller skates beneath his boots, and lo, the dogs of the world will break their teeth upon him." And he did show us a sign, right? Okay, it was over a posh haircut shop for ladies, but it was a sign. You can't argue with that. I mean, if it was obvious, anyone could show it to us.
Another sliver of fingernail hit the side of the glowing stove where it sizzled.
"And I ain't getting any younger, that's a fact. Probationary, though, that's not good. That's not good. What'd happen if I pop my clogs tomorrow, eh? I'd stand there before my forefathers and they'd say, 'Art thou Senior Postal Inspector Groat?' And I'd say, 'No.' And they'd say, 'Art thou then Postal Inspector Groat?' And I'd say, 'Not as such.' And they'd say, 'Then surely thou art Senior Postman Groat.' And I'd say, 'Not, in point of fact.' And they say, 'Stoner Crows, Tolliver, are you telling us you never got further than Junior Postman? What kind of groat are you?' And my face will be red, and I will be knee-deep in the ignominy. Don't matter that I've been running this place for years. Oh, no! You've got to have that gold button."
He stared at the fire, and somewhere in his matted beard a smile struggled to get out.
"He can try walking the walk," he said. "No one can argue if he walks the walk. And then I can tell him everything, so it'll be all right.
And if he don't walk to the end, then he ain't postmaster material anyway, Stanley. Stanley?
Stanley awoke from a dream of pins.
Yes, Mr. Groat.
Got a few errands for you to run, lad.
And if he ain't postmaster material, Groat added in the privacy of his creaking brain, I'll die a junior postman. It was hard to knock at a door while trying desperately not to make a sound, and in the end Crispin Horsefry gave up on the second aim and just swung on the door knocker. The sound echoed through the empty street, but no one came to the window. No one in this select street would have come to the window, even if a murder was going on. At least in the poorer districts people would have come out to watch or join in. The door opened.
"Good evening, sir."
Horsefry pushed past the stumpy figure and into the dark hallway, waving frantically to the servants to close the door.
"Shut it, man! Shut it! I may have been followed. Good grief, you're an Igor, aren't you? Gilt can afford an Igor."
"Well done, sir," said the Igor.
He peered out into the early evening darkness.
"All clear, sir."
"Shut the door, for God's sakes," moaned Horsefry. "I must see Mr. Gilt."
"The master is having one of his little soirees, sir," said Igor. "I will see if he can be disturbed."
"Are any of the others here? Have they... What's a soirees?"
"A little get-together, sir,"
said Igor, sniffing. The man reeked of drink.
"A soiree?"
"Exactly so, sir," said Igor impassively. "May I take your highly noticeable long-hooded cloak, sir, and be so kind as to follow me into the withdrawing-room?"
And suddenly Horsefry was alone in a big room full of shadows and candlelight and staring eyes, with a door closing behind him. The eyes belonged to the portraits in the big, dusty frames that filled the walls edge to edge. Rumour was that Gilt had bought them outright, and not only the pictures. It was said that he bought all the rights in the long dead as well, deed-polled their names, and thus equipped himself with a proud pedigree overnight. That was slightly worrying even for Horsefry. Everyone lied about their ancestors, and that was fair enough. Buying them was slightly disconcerting, but this dark, original stylishness was so very Reacher Gilt. A lot of rumours had begun concerning Reacher Gilt just as soon as people had noticed him and started asking, "Who is Reacher Gilt? What kind of a name is Reacher, anyway?" He threw big parties, that was certain. They were the kind of parties that entered urban mythology. Was it true about the chopped liver? Were you there? What about the time when he brought in a troll stripper and three people jumped out of the window? Were you there? And that story about the bowl of sweets? Were you there? Did you see it? Was it true? Were you there? Half of Ankh-Morpork had been, apparently, drifting from table to buffet, to dance floor, to gaming tables, every guest seemingly followed by a silent and obliging waiter with a laden drinks tray. Some said he owned a gold mine, others swore he was a pirate. And he certainly looked like a pirate, with his long, curly black hair, pointed beard and eye patch. He was even said to have a parrot. Certainly the piracy rumour might explain the apparently bottomless fortune and the fact that no one, absolutely no one, knew anything about him prior to his arrival in the city. Perhaps he'd sold his past, people joked, just like he'd bought himself a new one. He was certainly piratical in his business dealings, Horsefry knew. Some of the things, 12.5%, 12.5%. When he was sure that he hadn't in fact had the heart attack he had been expecting all day, Horsefry crossed the room, swaying just like a man who's had a little drink or two to steady his nerves, and lifted the dark red cloth that, it turned out, concealed the parrot cage. The bird was, in fact, a cockatoo, and it danced frantically up and down on its perch.
12.5%! 12.5%!
Horsefry grinned.
You've met Alphonse, said Reacher Gilt. And to what do I owe this unexpected pleasure, Crispin?
The door swung slowly behind him into its felt-lined frame, shutting out the sound of distant music. Horsefry turned, the brief moment of amusement evaporating instantly into the fearful turmoil of his soul. Gilt, one hand in the pocket of a beautiful smoking jacket, gave him a quizzical look.
"I'm being spied on, Reacher," Horsefry burst out. "Vetinari sent one of..."
"Please, sit down, Crispin. I think you require a large brandy."
He wrinkled his nose.
"Another large brandy, should I say?"
"I wouldn't say no. I'd have a little snifty, you know, just to calm my nerves. What a day I've had!"
Horsefry plumped down into a leather armchair.
"Did you know there was a watchman on duty outside the bank almost all afternoon?"
"A fat man, a sergeant?"
said Gilt, handing him a glass.
"'Fat, yes, I didn't notice his rank,' Horsefry sniffed. "'I've never had anything to do with the watch.'
"'I, on the other hand, have,' said Gilt, wincing to see very fine brandy drunk in the way Horsefry was drinking it. "'And I gather that Sergeant Colon is in the habit of loitering near large buildings in case they are stolen, but in fact simply because he enjoys a quiet smoke out of the wind. He's a clown, and not to be feared.'
"'Yes, but this morning one of the revenue officers came to see that old fool Cheeseborough.'
"'Is that unusual, Crispin?' said Gilt, soothingly. "'Let me top up your glass there.'
"'Well, they come once or twice a month,' Horsefry conceded, thrusting out the empty brandy glass. "'But
not unusual, then. You're shying at flies, my dear Crispin.'
"'Vetinari is spying on me,' Horsefry burst out. "'There was a man in black spying on the house this evening. I heard a noise, and I looked out, and I could see him standing in the corner of the garden.
A thief, perhaps?'
"'No, I'm fully paid up with the guild. I'm sure someone was in the house this afternoon, so things were moved in my study.' I'm worried, Reacher. I'm the one who stands to lose here, if there's an audit.
You know there won't be, Crispin. Gilt's voice was like honey.
Yes, but I can't get my hands on all the paperwork, not yet. Not until old Cheeseborough retires, and Vetinari's got lots of little, you know, what are they called? Clerks, you know, who do nothing but look at little bits of paper. They'll work it out, they will. We bought a grand trunk with some money.
Gilt patted him on the shoulder. Calm yourself, Crispin. Nothing is going to go wrong. You think about money in the old-fashioned way. Money is not a thing. It is not even a process. It is a kind of shared dream. We dream that a small disc of common metal is worth the price of a substantial meal. Once you wake up from that dream, you can swim in a sea of money.
The voice was almost hypnotic, but Horsefry's terror was driving him on. His forehead glistened.
"'Ingrenium's pissing in it!' he snapped, his little eyes aglint with desperate malice. "'You know that tower, Widgeshins of Lanka, that was giving all that trouble a couple of months ago? When we were told it was all due to witches flying into the towers? Ha! It was only a witch the first time. Then Greenium bribed a couple of the new men in the tower to call in a breakdown, and one of them rode like hell for the downstream tower and sent him the genuine market figures a good 2 hours before everyone else got them. That's how he cornered dried prawns, you know, and dried fishmore and dried ground shrimp.' It's not the first time he's done it either. A man is coining it.
Gilt looked at the man and wondered whether killing him now would be the best option. Vetinari was clever. You didn't stay ruler of a fermenting mess of a city like this one by being silly. If you saw his spy, it was a spy he wanted you to see. The way you'd know that Vetinari was keeping an eye on you would be by turning around very quickly and seeing no one at all. God's damn Greenium, too. Some people had no grasp, no grasp at all. They were so small. Using the clacks like that was stupid, but allowing a bottom feeder like Horsefry to find out about it was indefensible. It was silly. Silly, small people with the arrogance of kings running their little swindles, smiling at the people they stole from and not understanding money at all. And stupid, pig-like Horsefry had come running here. That made it a little tricky. The door was soundproofed, and the carpet was easily replaceable, and of course Igors were renowned for their discretion. But almost certainly someone unseen had watched the man walk in, and therefore it was prudent to ensure that he walked out.
"'You're a good man, Reacher Gilt,'
Horsefry hiccuped, waving the brandy glass unsteadily now that it was almost empty again. He put it down onto a small table with the exaggerated care of a drunk. But since it was the wrong one of the three images of the table sliding back and forth across his vision— The glass smashed on the carpet.
"'Sorry about that,' he slurred. "'You're a good man, so I'm going to give you this. I can't keep it in the house. Can't keep it. Not with Vetinari spies onto me. Can't burn it neither. It's got everything in it. All the little transactions, very important. Can't trust the others. They hate me. You take care of it, eh?'
He pulled out a battered red journal and proffered it unsteadily. Gilt took it and flicked it open. His eye ran down the entries.
"'You wrote everything down, Crispin,' he said.
"'Why?'
Crispin looked appalled.
"'Got to keep records, Reacher,' he said. "'Can't cover your tracks if you don't know where you left them. Then put it all back, see, hardly a crime at all.'
He tried to tap the side of his nose and missed.
"'I shall look after it with great care, Crispin,' said Gilt. "'You were very wise to bring it to me.'
"'That means a lot to me, Reacher.'
said Crispin, now heading for the maudlin stage.
"You take me serious, Susley, not like Greenium and his pals. I take the risks and then they treat me like drit. I mean, dirt. Bloody good chap you are. It's funny, you know, you having a Igor. Bloody good chap like you, because..."
He belched hugely.
"Because I heard that Igors only work for mad chaps. Totally bonkers chaps, you know, and vampires and whatnot. People who are a few pennies short of a picnic. Nothing against your man, Mark. You look bloody fine fellow." "Several bloody fine fellows."
Reacher Guilt pulled him up gently.
"You're drunk, Crispin," he said, "and too talkative. Now what I'm going to do is call Igor..."
"Yes, sir,"
said Igor behind him. It was the kind of service few could afford.
"And he'll take you home in my couch. Make sure you deliver him safely to his valet, Igor. Oh, and when you've done that, could you locate my colleague, Mr. Gryle? Tell him I have a little errand for him. Good night, Crispin."
Guilt patted the man on a wobbly cheek.
"And don't worry. Tomorrow you'll find all these little worries will have just disappeared."
"Very good chap,"
Horsefry mumbled happily.
"For a foreigner."
Igor took Crispin home. By that time the man had reached the jolly drunk stage and was singing the kind of song that's hilarious to rugby players and children under the age of 11, and getting him into his house must have awoken the neighbours, especially when he kept repeating the verse about the camel. Then Igor drove back home, put the coach away, saw to the horse, and went to the little pigeon loft behind the house. These were big, plump pigeons, not the diseased roof rats of the city, and he selected a particularly fat one, expertly slipped a silver message ring around its leg, and tossed it up into the night. Ankh-Morpork pigeons were quite bright, for pigeons. Stupidity had a limited life in this city. This one would soon find Mr. Gryle's rooftop lodgings, but it annoyed Igor that he never got its pigeons back. Old envelopes rose in drifts as Moist strode angrily, and sometimes waded angrily, through the abandoned rooms of the post office. He was in the mood to kick holes in walls. He was trapped. Trapped! He'd done his best, hadn't he? Perhaps there really was a curse on this place. Groat would be a good name for it. He pushed open a door and found himself in the big coachyard, around which the post office was bent like the letter U. It was still in use. When the postal service had collapsed, the coach part had survived, Groat had said. It was useful and established, and, besides, it owned scores of horses. You couldn't squash horses under the floor or bag them up in the attic. They had to be fed. More or less seamlessly, the coachman had taken it over and run it as a passenger service. Moist watched a laden coach roll out of the yard, and then movement up above caught his eye. You got used to the Clax Towers now. Sometimes it seemed as though every roof sprouted one. Most were the new shutterboxes installed by the Grand Trunk Company, but old-fashioned arm semaphores and even signal flags were still well in evidence. Those, though, only worked slowly and line of sight, and there was precious little space for that in the thrusting forest of towers. If you wanted more than that, you went to one of the little Clax companies and rented a small shutter tower with resident gargoyle to spot incoming messages, and access to the bounce towers, and if you were really rich, a trained operator as well. And you paid. Moist had no grasp of or interest in technology, but as he understood it, the price was something like an arm or a leg or both. But these observations orbited his brain, as it were, like planetary thoughts around one central solar thought. Why the hell have we got a tower? It was definitely on the roof. He could see it, and he could hear the distant rattle of the shutters. And he was sure he'd seen a head before it ducked out of sight. Why have we got a tower up there, and who is using it? He ran back inside. He'd never spotted a staircase to the roof, but then who knew what was hidden behind some pile of letters at the end of some blocked corridor? He squeezed his way along yet another passage lined with mail sacks and came out into a space where big, bolted double doors led back to the yard. There were stairs there leading upwards. Little safety lamps bled little pools of light into the blackness above. That was the post office for you, Moist thought. The regulations said the stairs must be lit, and lit they were, decades after anyone ever used them, except for Stanley the lamplighter. There was an old freight elevator here, too, one of those dangerous ones that worked by pumping water in and out of a big rainwater tank on the roof. But he couldn't work out how to make it go, and wouldn't have trusted it if he could. Groat had said it was broken. At the foot of the stairs, scuffed but still recognisable, was a chalk outline. The arms and legs were not in comfortable positions. Moist swallowed, but gripped the banister. He climbed. There was a door on the first floor. It opened easily. It burst open at the mere touch of the handle, spilling pent-up mail out into the stairwell like some leaping monster. Moist swayed and whimpered as the letters slithered past him shoal after shoal and cascaded down the stairs. Woodenly, he climbed up another flight and found another dimly lit door, but this time he stood to one side as he opened it. The force of the letters still rounded against his legs, and the noise of the dead letters was a dry whispering as they poured away into the gloom. Like bats, perhaps. This whole building, full of dead letters, whispering to one another in the dark as a man fell to his death. Any more of this, and he'd end up like Groat, as mad as a spoon. But there was more to this place. Somewhere there had to be a door. His head was all over the wall. "Look," he said to his imagination, "if this is how you're going to behave, I shan't bring you again." But, with its usual treachery, it went on working. He'd never, ever laid a finger on anyone. He'd always run rather than fight. And murder, now, surely murder was an absolute. You couldn't commit 0.021 of a murder, could you? But Pump seemed to think you could murder with a ruler. Okay, perhaps somewhere downstream people were inconvenienced by a crime, but what about bankers, landlords, even barmen? "Here's your double brandy, sir, and I've 0.0003 killed you." Everything, everyone did affected everyone, sooner or later. Besides, a lot of his crimes weren't even crimes. Take the ring trick now. He never said it was a diamond ring. Besides, it was depressing how quickly honest citizens warmed to an opportunity to take advantage of a poor, benighted traveller. It could ruin a man's faith in human nature, if he had one. Besides. The third floor yielded another avalanche of letters, but when they subsided there was still a wall of paper plugging the corridor beyond. One or two rustling envelopes fell out, threatening a further fall as Moist advanced. In fact, it was retreat that was at the top of his mind, but the stairs were now layered with sliding envelopes, and this was not the time to learn dry slope skiing. Well, the fifth floor would have to be clear, wouldn't it? How else could Sideburn have got to the stairs in order to meet his appointment with Eternity? And yes, there was still a piece of black and yellow rope on the fourth floor landing on a drift of letters. The watch had been here. Nevertheless, Moist opened the door with care, as a watchman must have done. One or two letters fell out, but the main slide had already taken place. A few feet beyond, there was the familiar wall of letters, packed as tight as rock strata. A watchman had been in here too. Someone had tried to break through the word face, and Moist could see the hole. They'd put in their arm full length, just like Moist was doing. Just like his, their fingertips had brushed against yet more compacted envelopes. No one had got onto the stairs here. They would have had to walk through a wall of envelopes at least 6 feet thick. There was one more flight. Moist climbed the stairs cautiously and was halfway up when he heard the slide begin below him. He must have disturbed the wall of letters on the floor below somehow. It was emerging from the corridor with the unstoppability of a glacier. As the leading edge reached the stairwell, chunks of mail broke off and plunged into the depths. Far below, wood creaked and snapped. The stairway shivered. Moist ran up the last few steps to the fifth floor, grabbed the door there, pulled it open, and hung on as another mail slide poured past him. Everything was shaking now. There was a sudden crack as the rest of the staircase gave way and left Moist swinging from the handle, letters brushing past. He swung there, eyes shut, until the noise and movement had more or less died away, although there was still the occasional creak from below. The stairs were gone. With great care, Moist brought his feet up until he could feel the edge of the new corridor. Without doing anything so provocative as breathing, he changed his grip on the door so that now he had a hold of the handle on both sides. Slowly, he walked his heels through the drift of letters on the corridor floor, thus pulling the door closed while at the same time getting both his hands onto the inner handle. Then he took a deep breath of the stale, dry air, scrabbled madly with his feet, bent his body like a hooked salmon, and ended up with just enough of himself on the corridor floor to prevent a fall through 60 feet of letters and broken woodwork. Barely thinking, he unhooked the lamp from the doorpost and turned to survey the task ahead. The corridor was brightly lit, richly carpeted, and completely free of mail. Moist stared. There had been letters in there, wedged tight from floor to ceiling. He'd seen them, and felt them fall past him into the stairwell. They hadn't been a hallucination. They'd been solid, musty, dusty, and real. To believe anything else now would be madness. He turned back to look at the wreckage of the stairs and saw no doorway, no stairs. The carpeted floor extended all the way to the far wall. Moist realized that there had to be an explanation for this, but the only one he could think of now was... It's strange. He reached down gingerly to touch the carpet where the stairwell should be, and felt a chill on his fingertips as they passed through. And he wondered, did one of the other new postmasters stand here, just where I am? And did he walk out over what looked like solid floor and end up rolling down 5 flights of pain? Moist inched his way along the corridor in the opposite direction, and sound began to grow. It was vague and generalized, the noise of a big building hard at work, shouts, conversations, the rattle of machinery, the crowded susurrus of 1,000 voices and wheels and footfalls and stampings and scribblings and slammings, all woven together in a huge space to become the pure, audible texture of commerce. The corridor opened out ahead of him, where it met a T-junction. The noise was coming from the brightly lit space beyond. Moist walked towards the shining brass railing of the balcony ahead and stopped. All right. The brain had been carried all the way up here at great expense. Now it was time for it to do some work. The hall of the post office was a dark cavern filled with mountains of mail. There were no balconies, no shining brasswork, no bustling staff, and as sure as hell there were no customers. The only time the post office could have looked like this was in the past, yes? There were balconies, sir, all round the big hall, on every floor, made of iron like lace. But they weren't in the present. Not in the here and now. Yet he wasn't in the past. Not exactly. His fingers had felt a stairwell when his eyes had seen carpeted floor. Moist decided that he was standing in the here and now, but seeing in the here and then. Of course, you'd have to be mad to believe it. But this was the post office. Poor Mr. Sideburn had stepped out onto a floor that wasn't there anymore. Moist stopped before stepping out onto the balcony, reached down, and felt the chill on his fingertips once again as they went through the carpet. Who was it? Oh, yes, Mr. Mutable. He'd stood here, rushed to look down, and... Smack, sir! Smack onto the marble! Moist stood up carefully, steadied himself against the wall, and peered gingerly into the big hall. Chandeliers hung from the ceiling, but they were unlit because sunlight was pouring through the sparkling dome onto a scene innocent of pigeon droppings, but alive with people scuttling across the checkerboard floor or hard at work behind the long, polished counters made of rare wood, my dad said. Moist stood and stared. It was a scene made up of 100 purposeful activities that fused happily into a great anarchy. Below him, big wire baskets on wheels were being manhandled across the floor. Sacks of letters were being tipped on moving belts. Clerks were feverishly filling the pigeonholes. It was a machine made of people, sir. You should have seen it. Away to Moist's left, at the far end of the hall, was a golden statue 3 or 4 times life-size. It was of a golden, slim young man, obviously a god, wearing nothing more than a hat with wings on, sandals with wings on, and, Moist squinted, a fig leaf with wings on. He'd been caught by the sculptor as he was about to leap into the air, carrying an envelope and wearing an expression of noble purpose. It dominated the hall. It wasn't there in the present day. The dais was unoccupied. If the counters and the chandeliers were gone, a statue that even looked like gold must have stood no chance. It had probably been the spirit of the post, or something. Meanwhile, the mail down there was moving more prosaically. Right under the dome was a clock with a face pointing in each of the 4 directions. As Moist watched it, the big hand clanked to the top of the hour. A horn blew. The frantic ballet ceased as, somewhere below Moist, some doors opened and 2 lines of men, in the uniform, sir, royal blue with brass buttons, you should have seen them, marched in the hall in 2 lines and stood to attention in front of the big doors. A large man, in a rather grander version of the uniform and with a face like a toothache, was waiting there for them. He wore a large hourglass hanging in a gimbaled brass cage at his belt, and he looked at the waiting men as if he had seen worse sights but not often, and even then only on the soles of his enormous boots. He held up the hourglass with an air of evil satisfaction and took a deep breath before roaring, "Number 4 delivery! Stand!" The words reached Moist's ears slightly muffled, as though he was hearing them through cardboard. The postman, already at attention, contrived to look even more alert. The big man glared at them and took another huge gulp of air.
Number three delivery! Wait for it, wait for it! Deliver!
The two lines marched past him and out into the day. Once we were postmen. I've got to find a real stairway, Moist thought, pushing himself away from the edge. I'm hallucinating the past, but I'm standing in the present. It's like sleepwalking. I don't want to walk out onto fresh air and end up as one more chalk outline. He turned around and someone walked right through him. The sensation was unpleasant, like a sudden snap of fever. But that wasn't the worst part. The worst part is seeing someone's head walk through yours. The view is mostly grey, with traces of red and hollow hints of sinus. You would not wish to know about the eyeballs. Face like a mask, sir, like it's in a ghost. Moist's stomach heaved, and as he turned with his hand over his mouth, he saw a young postman looking in his general direction with a look of horror that probably reflected the one on the unseen Moist's face. Then the boy shivered and hurried away.